Ben, good to see you back on the No One Fights Alone podcast. How are you?
Good. Good to see you, Brad. How's life, man?
Man, catching up on a little rest. Last week was a busy week. A little bit of travel and marketing business development stuff for Chateau. And, you know, I really enjoy traveling. I get to meet some of the greatest people out on the road. There are a lot of good people doing work in this space. You just don't get to see them a lot. I have the neat opportunity to meet a lot of folks. Louisville, Lexington, Kentucky, Indianapolis. Ended up in Orlando for the Survive First Gala. That was awesome. Amazing. Really. But it's, yeah, I'm pretty tired. Pretty wiped. How are things?
Kissing babies. Of course. Doing the usual thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Promoting Chateau and all the great things that you guys do up there. How's things at Chateau?
Things are good. We got a. It's obviously we're under 2 months now from when we get into our remodeled upgrade building. It's a huge production. My wife is in charge of the design aspect of getting this massive building. You know, the textures, colors, the furniture, all of those kinds of things, stuff I constantly take for granted. A thing like a sconce or a rug, I don't even notice them and I don't even think about them when I walk into a room. I'll tell you what, when you have a garage that has 50 of all of those things, you tend to look at the world a little bit differently. So yeah, my garage is just packed full of all sorts of stuff. And it's the stuff you don't think about.
I am really excited about this. For the listeners, I know we're going to devote an entire podcast to this transition. There's a lot of questions about as we grow, are we going to be able to keep the Chateau feel? And you all have that covered. I don't want to get into it now, but I think it would be really good to have that on a podcast. And I know that's our intention when we get a little closer. We're a few months out. Well, hopefully a couple months out from opening the door. We'll see. But it's pretty exciting stuff. Pretty exciting stuff.
It is. It's cool. To be honest, I've had to learn a lot. My wife, she's the one managing kind of the feel of the building, right? There's lots of buildings out there. We've all been to different buildings that some feel like hospitals, some feel like morgues, some feel like some different things. And there's a lot of psychology and there's a lot of design aspects about the environment we're in. Where does our eye go and how do we feel calm? And basically, how do you create a design to help your nervous system slow down and calm down? And there's things like that I never even think about. So it's been a good education about how that stuff kind of happens in all of our usual homes and how this applies to a place like that.
I feel like you're paying her a compliment here. It has a strong feel that you're giving a nod to.
Dangerously close. Some days I'm like, if I see another wicker basket, I'm going to lose my mind. But she has put a ton of time, a ton of energy into just the little things that we all kind of take for granted. And it is. She's been incredible. She's put a ton of work into it. And I think people will eventually appreciate it. But for now, it's just lots of study and lots of support.
It will be eventual. I think it will be very sudden and very frontal. Yeah. It's a beautiful facility anyway.
Yeah.
And to just hearing you and others talk about what she's doing in there is pretty amazing. But our guest today was a fantastic conversation. Just amazing. Our guest is Jody Balcom, who's author of the book Choosing My Tomorrow, Surviving Murder, Navigating Mental Health, and Harnessing the Power of Choice. And I found the book really fascinating, really heavy at times. Really, she does a great job of taking you on a journey through a pretty painful time in her life. And that in and of itself had to have been hard. Just I'm going to open up my coat and show everything. But she wraps it up into some lessons that are pretty fantastic.
No, my final thoughts on her got wrapped up in some internet issues towards the end. For me, visiting with her kind of answered the question of how do I hope I respond to tragedy? Because she does a great job of talking about just the challenge, the gritty honesty around some of the details that we often kind of overlook, but also her walking out on the other side, pretty strong, pretty confident, and just is a pretty great role model of how we all should show up after something rough happens to us and being of service to other people. So I thought she was great and she demonstrated it the whole time.
Oftentimes we look at folks like Jody as, wow, they nailed it. Yeah, they killed it.
Right.
No mistakes, no stubborn toes. I could never do that. And the nuances of the book are she did have mess ups and mistakes and hurts and pains. And it's just this journey of how you, and through through taking us, the reader, on that book through a journey of, I'm going to take you along for the ride and show you how difficult this actually was. And if it helps another human being, then that's what I want out of this. I feel like that was kind of the culmination. Is that fair?
I loved it. No, it was super fair because I think it's one of those, like you said, she wasn't as equipped as equipped as any of us are. And she showed up anyway.
Right.
And I think that's just really cool stuff. So I was super impressed. I thought she did a great
job. Well, for our listeners, we won't hesitate anymore. We won't hold you in suspense any longer. We're going to dive into a conversation with Jody Balkin. Enjoy.
Welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast. This podcast is dedicated to mental wellness for first responders and beyond. Through powerful stories, personal experiences, and expert insights, we explore the challenges and triumphs of maintaining resilience in the face of adversity. Together, we remind you, no one fights alone.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the No One Fights Alone podcast. We have Jody Balkin with us today. Welcome to the podcast, Jody.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm going to give a quick bio on Jody, but she is a she's a fascinating human being. I've enjoyed so much visiting with her and getting to know her just in the short time. But Jody's a former teacher, life coach, leadership design specialist. But the reason we have her on today is because we're highlighting a book, Choosing My Tomorrow. There it is. Surviving Murder, Navigating Mental Health, and Harnessing the Power of Choice. Even though we're having a positive conversation, it's really a story of a lot of pain and hurt and grief and navigating that. So, Jody, thank you for coming on. Love having you on the podcast. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, Jody, we want to just kind of dive in it because you got a lot. I feel like we're going to have a great conversation. So let's just dive in it. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do today before we kind of get into the history of you do some fascinating things today, life coaching and tell us a little bit about who you are.
Yeah. Who am I? Jody Balkin. I'm the third daughter of four, grew up in rural Ontario, was a high school athlete in a small farming community. I went off to university, did my kinesiology degree, and then I traveled to Australia where I did my education degree. And at that time, I was engaged to a young man. We were 23 and 24 years old. Chris was his name. He was a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer, and his first posting was in Canada's Arctic. And so I flew from Sydney, Australia to Yellowknife, Northwest Territories to start my life with him. I'm not sure if we want to go all of the way through that story, but what am I doing today, 17 years later, after having worked in the RCMP as a civilian in their learning and development section for a number of years. I just recently stepped out of that role after receiving a breast cancer diagnosis that led me to a lot of reflection on where I am in my life and all of the things. What do I want to be when I grow up? I mean, that happened to me 2 years ago when I was only 44. So it gave me some pause and reflection, and that turned into journaling, which turned into writing of the book. And so right now I am public speaking. I am coaching individuals through life and grief journeys and just doing what I can to share my story of struggle and coming out on the other side of that and helping others see that when we are vulnerable enough to step into sharing, that really does offer hope to other people. And so there is a lot of power in our storytelling. So just doing that more often.
I am going to apologize for not including cancer survivor in there. I knew that. I remember that in our conversation. I apologize. Mm-hmm. So a cancer survivor, that's a big part of who you are as well. Thanks for reminding me of that. No, this is great. I think this would be a great segue to get into you and Chris going into the far outreaches of the Northwest area.
Yeah. So yeah, Chris was policing in Yellowknife. I got a job as a teacher. Now, Yellowknife was the big city. I mean, it was like 18,500 people and we had a Walmart. So that, you know, put us on the map from a location perspective.
Big deal.
And all of the amenities, right? After 2 years there, he was transferred to a small fly-in only settlement of 500 people. Again, two police officers. He was the constable. His boss was the corporal. I worked in the school there, which was went from kindergarten to adult basic education. So everything in one place. We were there for about 2 years. And then he transferred again to Hay River Northwest Territories, which is a town of 3,500 people on the road system, which was also very exciting. I was teaching at the high school there while he was policing. It was a Canadian Thanksgiving weekend in October of 2007. He had actually come home from his shift, but he was on call. We were going to be leaving on vacation the next day. So he covered a colleague's shift knowing that we were going to be gone for that period of time. And it was while he was at home, the call came in. So he got dressed and he changed and he went out the house at about 2:30 in the morning. I was on maternity leave with our 8-month-old daughter, Alexis, at the time. And while I was up changing her at 5:30 a.m., I heard a knock at the door. And so I put Alexis back into her crib and I went and answered the door. And on the other side was a friend of mine and a colleague of Chris's in her uniform. She still had sleep lines on her face. And she said, asked if Chris was home. And I said, no, he had been called out a few hours ago. And she said, well, we can't seem to reach him. And so she left and said that she'd be in touch. And so I went back up to get Alexis out of her crib. And while I'm bouncing her on my hip, I called my girlfriend, Cindy, who lived just down the street. And I was waiting for her to arrive. And as she's walking up the driveway, a police car also pulls in. And Chris's corporal, Mike, gets out and says that they found him and they've taken him to the hospital. So we get into the car and, you know, nothing is very far in these small communities. It's only about a 5-minute drive. And it's very commonplace for patients to be stabilized at the community hospital and then medevaced for greater care. So in my mind, I'm preparing myself to go to Yellowknife or south to Edmonton for treatment. And so we get to the hospital, we make our way into the ER, the nurse confirms that Chris is in the back with the doctors. At that point, I start writing a list of Alexis's routine. Because still, like in my mind, I'm going to go and take care of Chris and I'm going to leave Alexis with Cindy. And while I'm doing that, there's a presence beside me and it's Mike. And I find myself getting led into a small room off of the main corridor of the hallway. And he asks me to sit down. He closes the door and then he gets down on one knee. And so before the words even leave his mouth, I know that,
you know,
in that moment that Chris is gone, I've lost my best friend. Alexis will never grow up to know her dad, and that my world is forever changed because in that moment I became a widow and an only parent and a 29-year-old who is now caught in a reality that I wanted no part of.
What an awful, awful journey. And I know you condensed down right there, you know, into seconds what were probably pretty painful minutes and hour, if not hours, in a journey. But this tees up, you know, I'm going to keep you moving a little bit. This tees up a kind of a next chapter of a lot within your book. It's actually really amazing how you unpack this of just a absolute roller coaster of a few years.
Yeah.
Take us on that.
Well, it wasn't just that Chris was shot and killed. It's that they didn't know where the shooter was for 6 days. And so there was the manhunt around that. And then there was the media reporting and filling in gaps without having accurate answers. There were police stationed outside of my little house. You know, there were snipers around, you know, trying to protect us because they didn't know if this was targeted or not. Then living so far away from Chris's hometown, you know, dealing remotely with family. And I was told that I couldn't call Chris's parents until they received the note of the next of kin.
Right.
And that part for me was one of the most excruciating and agonizing episodes in my life, because I had this information about their son that was going to devastate them and I wasn't allowed to call and share it. And so for those 4 hours before they were able to get in contact, and it was actually his parents' wedding anniversary on the day that he was murdered. And so they were having a brunch at their house with Chris's two siblings. One of them was traveling in London, England, and the international policing community, Interpol, actually found Peter and gave him the news before he would be able to hear it when he came back or en route or however, you know, just to try to give him the information before he found it out in a different way. So there was a lot, so many moving parts with all of this. So you've got the grief of, I wouldn't even say the grief then, that was just
right,
shock.
Right.
That was just shock. You couldn't actually get into processing things. And so, you know, a small community, people have scanners, people were showing up at my house. I wasn't really prepared for that level of what is support from their perspective. But when you're in it, it just feels like it's overwhelming. And so all of this was happening. And then I'm being asked, you know, do you want a regimental funeral or a civic funeral? Where do you want that to take place? And so all of those decisions are having to be made. I went into project manager role pretty quick. You know, I grasped onto the things that I felt like I had a sense of control over. And so really, you know, there were some things that I offered Chris's family to have a say in a little bit more if I didn't have a strong feeling one way or the other. But what we decided was that we would do a full regimental funeral. It would take place in our nation's capital in Ottawa, which is his hometown. And so I stayed in the territories for 5 days until it got coordinated for me to be flown back to see Chris's folks and to make those plans. It was also election weekend, the weekend that he died.
Oh, I forgot and so that about
there was
the book.
The backdrop of all of so the autopsy was done in Edmonton. He was shot 4 times, once in the thigh, once just in through the pubic bone, through the chest muscle that exited and then went into his arm. And then the final blow was through the jugular. And he was shot by a drug dealer, a 20-year-old drug dealer who was not from the territories, that had come from the south up north to do all of his dealings. He had a record that was longer than your arm. He had a firearm prohibition, clearly that wasn't supported. So dealing with waiting for that news that he was found. And so once I got into Ottawa, and every day we were trying to get updates, but because of the way that investigations go, you're not able to have that information. Yeah. So that was also really, really difficult to wait and not know. But 6 days later, he was apprehended in Edmonton through a joint operation with a number of different police forces. And so that gave us a little bit of relief, because we really wanted that to take place before we had the funeral. We wanted that to be kind of closed and wrapped up, even though we knew that the judicial system was going to take time. To know that he was behind bars so that we could feel safer while we were honoring Chris was really important to us.
Yep. Well, we don't have to give him any credence or any allowances of time on this one, because he's a scumbag and he's where he belongs. But but you're moving towards the actual funeral here, and I love the there's so much of this being heavily involved and behind the scenes in a lot of line of duty death funerals. I was telling Ben the other day that your book just resonated so deeply with me on so many. But there's two funerals of mine that were very impactful, and your book is so descriptive of this. Really took me to a pretty dark place. But there's a lot of gratitude, you know, in that, of just knowing, hey, we're in this space. And I know we're going to talk about that here in a little bit, but the book is so good, and just you telling step by step what you're thinking, what you're feeling in these moments, and how difficult it is to actually navigate a ton of decisions. It doesn't give the full gravity, because unless you're there, which I was on the other side, I was speaking with widows and saying, I know this is overwhelming, but I need you to make a decision on this. And this is, it's imminent. We can't wait any longer. We have to have, you know, this and this and this and this and this. And your detailing that out was pretty amazing. And albeit in that moment, you were just overwhelmed. It is incredibly overwhelming, because of you don't have the luxury of just taking a minute for yourself and just, I've just lost my best friend. I've just lost, my life will forever be changed. Mm-hmm. Will never be the same. I was robbed, essentially. So funeral, let's go towards the funeral.
Yeah, funeral. I would say, when you talk about being overwhelmed, my worst day was the day that I needed to go to the funeral home to pick out a casket. I was brought in there, and Chris was 6'2", 220 pounds. And so the director says, well, there's only two that he actually physically fits in. And so, you know, is it this one or this one? And I was like, okay, well, I like the stain on that one. So let's go with the cherry wood. Then from there, I was brought to we were both raised Catholic, and so we had a Catholic service. And so I met with the priest and the deacon at the church. And luckily for me, I got some of my friends to kind of go through and shortlist some readings for me that are typical at Catholic funerals. So I had a short list there. And so, you know, we're going through all of those things and the sequence of the day, and the capacity of the church was an issue for the amount of people that wanted to come. 500 police officers were going to be marching from across Canada and the States. We had family members. Chris was from there. And so we actually had to make a guest list of who was going to be allowed in the church. And then one of our local broadcasting centers was going to be putting up big screens to be able to support the viewing of things outside. So you're adding that to, like, you're creating a funeral list. Like the last time I had done that, it was a wedding list. And then
So weird.
The thought process around that was really interesting, right? And so, and this was nearly 18 years ago. So you didn't just have like a QR code that you can scan to get in. Like these needed to be like physically delivered or emails. So that logistical part, which fortunately the RCMP took care of, but you know, many people behind the scenes supporting that work. And so from the church, then I went to the cemetery. And Beechwood Cemetery is the National Military and Police Officer Cemetery. So again, in the age before kind of iPads were your best friend walking around, I had the director with a large piece of Bristol board that had all of the plots that were available. And so we're going around and we're walking around and he's like, well, you can have this one and you can have like two or four people. This is a double. And that's when I just walked away. I'm like, I'm out. And one of the RCMP members came and said, you know, what's going on? I said, I am 29 years old. I don't want to be buried with Chris or think about being buried with him because I have a whole nother life to leave. And that brought on a huge amount of guilt.
Right.
Like, what am I doing 8 days later having these awarenesses? Like, that's when I kind of, you know, fell to my knees, broke down there. And the officer just said to me, he's like, you don't need to make those decisions today. You just pick a spot where you think that he would be comfortable. And Chris was a tall, bald man. I never knew him to have hair, but he was a redhead when he did have hair. Yeah. And so, you know, I found a tree. I'm like, you know, you're fair skin, you know, so just go under the shady tree. And so, you know, it was that was my worst day because those decisions, I think I made all of them in about 4 hours.
Yeah.
And I was just spent. And then the day of the funeral, there's a lot of procedure and pomp. And I'm really thankful that we were walked through what that, you know, I just had to get into the car and I was driven places.
Sure.
But what they did do, so Alexis was 8 months old, and the tailors from the RCMP came to Chris's parents' house and they measured her for a little red serge that would mirror Chris's, like with his cross pistols and his one star because he had 6 years and all of the things. So I'm holding Alexis and she just looks like this little doll dressed in a red serge. Yeah. So that supported making national news, right? The imagery of me dressed in black. And I said to my sister, took me shopping and we were out and I'm just like, well, if I've got to do this, I better as well, like, I want to look like Jackie O. Like, let me look like her. Like, if I've got to be out there, like, let me at least be stylish.
I got to kill it. About it,
right?
Yeah.
So that was kind of that day. The service itself is a blur. And then after we get to the cemetery, and that's where I don't remember things after that. We talk about overwhelm and you've just reached your capacity. There are pictures of me in places talking with people and I have no recollection of being there.
You brought up Alexis. I'm gonna hit a pause button here real quick because I feel like I want to honor Chris a little bit in actually talking about him, because we're talking around him right now a little bit. But your book, within the book, it feels like you kind of get to know him a little bit. I mean, football player. So what made me think about that was Alexis and wearing the serge. What a beautiful picture that must have been in in her outfit. But tell us a little bit about Chris before we kind of finish out this, like what kind of guy was he?
I appreciate the question. You're right, he was a larger than life spirit. He was funny, he was athletic, he was academic. You know, he went over to Australia as well during his university and studied international policies and politics. He was a go-getter, a high flyer. You know, it wasn't content just being a constable. I mean, there's very respectable work, but he always had aspirations to do what he could to advance. He wanted to be on it's called ERT team here, I think SWAT team in the States, you know, just always wanting to maintain his physical presence in order to support people. So even though he had an intimidating physical presence, his mouth was his greatest weapon. He was able to diffuse situations with his words. He was able to make both males and females alike feel very comfortable to share. He was DARE trained. So he was going into schools, teaching about drugs to the kids in grade 6 or 7. So all of those things from, you know, his ambition and his compassion and his desire to keep people safe. He was the oldest of 4 kids in his family as well. So I think always having that protector role and taking care of the younger kids. He's got 2 brothers and a sister that will talk about, you know, shenanigans growing up. And he was always pretty jovial. And that smile that he had was something that I bring to mind very often. It does make me feel that sense of love and joy still is when I picture his smile. And honestly, I mean, you're looking at me, I have salt and pepper hair now, but it's brown. I have brown eyes. My daughter is a red, curly, red-headed, green hair kid. She's the spitting image of Chris. And so there's things that she does that I just like, okay, there it is. You know, that is totally coming from a different place, coming from him. So I get to see that and enjoy that on a day-to-day basis too.
That's actually what made me think about it, because when we talked the first time, you were talking about Alexis being such a reminder of, you know, a mini-me, my words, I don't think you said that, but a mini-me of Chris. Mm-hmm. And when you were talking about the surge, I just thought, man, we need to take a minute here of just of talking about who Chris is. So thank you for that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So where we were at in kind of before, we were at, you know, this overwhelmed part and you were starting to shut down and you had no mental memory. Sorry. You had no memory of some of the graveside that, so let's kind of start back in there.
Yeah. So I do remember receiving the flag, and then it kind of like the 24 hours after that is non-existent for me. I was staying in Chris's parents' house. My family had driven 8 hours from where they live. They were in a motorhome outside on the street. My sister was sleeping with me in the bed in the house. And I'm trying to think, that was 2 days after the funeral. And then the election and the political part comes back into play a little bit here. So the conservative government was elected again. So Prime Minister Stephen Harper was going into his second term and he was advocating for his tough on crime bill. And so his office reached out to me via the RCMP and asked me if I would attend the throne speech, which is basically telling the public what the mandate of the government is going to be for the next few years. And so that was a decision that was, it wasn't difficult for me to make, but there were outside influences. All of Chris's family that went to schools, his 3 siblings and his dad, they all have political science degrees. Mm. And so politics is a very lively conversation. I mean, I voted as soon as I was able to, but politics didn't play the same level of importance in my life as it did in his family. And so there were different views about whether or not I should attend. And they didn't want me to, but I said, I am going. Like, this is really important. We are not tough enough on our criminals right now. In my opinion, we still aren't. That's another conversation. But yeah, I went and I sat beside the prime minister's wife. And I knew I was going to be a soundbite at that time. I wasn't naive enough to just think that this was going to just support them. But I thought, well, maybe in the future, this will also support me somehow. And so made that choice and that decision. And that started a little bit of my advocacy work. And that lasted for a few years. And we can talk about what those changes were inside of the RCMP. But that's where I started to want to place this, all of these emotions that I didn't know what to do with, into something. And so then I kind of shifted. I hadn't even gotten into grieving yet. I was still kind of in shock and moved into trying to channel whatever was coming up for me in that advocacy role. And then I took Alexis back up north to kind of start our lives again without all of the other things around us. And so that's what I did. And I stayed up there for 8 months. During a month after Chris was shot, another young member was shot in the Arctic as well. And all of this was, they were going out to calls by themselves. They didn't have backup policy in place. They were in these cars alone. And so that's, I started advocating for backup policy within the RCMP. And that was implemented about a year later. Policies were drafted. Are they as robust as I would like? No, but it did change some things inside and the perception of what it looks like when you're policing in the north in these smaller communities. I stayed up in Hay River for 8 months until the preliminary inquiry concluded. So that was the first step in order to ensure that they would go to trial. And so after that time, I decided to move to Ottawa and restart our lives together there. My folks were still very involved in their business. I didn't see myself going back to farming community at 29, so moved closer to Chris's folks and started over there.
I have to admit, in the book, by the way, I looked up, I remember the picture of you with, sorry to back us up here a little bit, there, but there's a great picture of you and the prime meeting the prime minister. Did I say that right? Prime minister. There's a great picture in the book about that. But I have to admit this, like you, this is a natural pause and you feel that in the book, you feel it's, I found myself almost like taking a breath for you. Like, okay, she's getting out of there. Yeah. You know, just, she's like, it had that feel. It has that feel in the book. Like get just, I mean, I'm like, just get out of there. Just go. Just it's time. You know, and that's where you were at in that space. So yeah, that's an incredible portion of the book. What you just narrated within the book. If any of the listeners are interested in reading this book, which it gets better, I think the best part of this book is yet to come, which we'll discuss here in a little bit. But this starts at a pretty amazing. I use that term loosely because I want to speak for you, but in the book, it's a pretty amazing next chapter here of growth and healing and pain and confusion and just a lot. What happens next?
What happens next? I was invited by the RCMP to sit on a committee that helped to create resources for RCMP families. And it was through that exposure where I learned of a paid position in their learning and development section that was creating courses for new supervisors and new managers. So about a year after, year and a half after Chris's murder, I became a paid employee of the RCMP in their learning and development section in January 2009. And so at this time, you know, I was starting to make new relationships with people that I work with. Alexis was going to daycare. So I was recreating my sense of self. I think being a teacher helped me step into that growth mindset. You know, continuously, you know, what can I learn? How can I move forward? I very early on was able to acknowledge a lot of my feelings, let them have their time and their space, but then always kind of look forward to be, well what's next? And part of that as well, Alexis being so young, she didn't have, like, her life didn't stop because she was sad. And so I think I took 2 Ativan pills while I was in the very first days after Chris, and that's all that I took. I'm like, I can't feel like this. My baby needs me. So let's figure out what that looks like for her. So I threw myself into momming and doing what I could to support her. But at the same time, knowing that me being a full-time mom, I wanted and needed more in order to be the best mom that I could. And that's where stepping into the RCMP in a professional capacity supported me very well in being able to be the best mom that I could for her.
Sure. And then you detail this out a lot, and I don't want to take it away from the listeners. Listeners need to get the book and read it, but you met Brent.
I met Brent. Yes. So it was through that work and exposure that, yes, I fell in love with another RCMP officer, but I'm like, you need to have a desk job. Like, I'm done with operations. Yeah. And Brent did. He actually moved from Edmonton to Ottawa to create a peer support program. So police officers would talk to each other about the things that they saw on duty in an effort to, you know, create a sense of community and reduce the stigma around these things. And he was ready to pilot the program in 2 divisions when the program funding was cut. And by the same government that was going to be tough on crime, they went through a deficit reduction action plan. And each of the departments had to cut like 20% of their budget. And so the RCMP decided right now wasn't the time to support this program. And it was very shortly after that he started to exhibit serious signs of declining mental health. And he was off duty sick for 2 years. He had 3 failed gradual return to works and months of suicidal ideation before he medically retired just about 10 years ago in May of 2015 with the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder and major depressive disorder.
And how's he doing today?
He's doing very well today. Yeah. We actually made the decision 4 years ago to move from Ontario and Ontario to Alberta to be closer to his side of the family. He was brought up in the West. His two sons from his previous marriage are out this way. And so took a leap of faith that that would help to create a more functional family dynamic. And it really has. It really has. He's doing very well now. Thank you.
So before we kind of get into some of the tail end of the book, do you mind me asking about your cancer? Would you mind speaking to a little bit of that difficult journey as well?
Sure. So, you know, we thought that we were moving across the country in order to support Brent's health. And then that was trending in a positive direction. And just over a year later, I mean, finding family doctors can be very challenging when you move provinces. And so we were lucky enough to find someone that would take the three of us. And so in order for the doctor to get to know us, we went for all of this testing. And that included a mammogram for me. Now, this was not something that I had had previously because in Ontario, where we were living before, you did not qualify for a mammogram until you're 50. Unless you had a family history, which I did not. Mm-hmm. And so at 44, when I was sent for a mammogram, I was very thankful that I was getting screened because then they would have a baseline. Well, then there were some calcifications that were shown on the mammogram. So then I was sent for an ultrasound and they weren't able to rule anything out. So that's when I went for a biopsy. And so all of that happened. And 10 days from the mammogram, that was when I received the diagnosis. And they told me that it was very small. It was just about like 1 centimeter. And so they were going to do a lumpectomy, which I agreed to. And then I had that surgery. And then in the pathology, they have to check the margins. And if the margins still had cancer, then they knew that they needed to go back in and get more. So they did. They did a second lumpectomy. Those margins still did not come back clear. The third surgery was checking my lymph nodes just to see if it had spread into the other parts of my body. Fortunately, it had not. And then at that point, I requested a double mastectomy. I said, the imagery, the MRI, they're not seeing it all. And so I want them gone. And so in January of 2023, so I was diagnosed October, had the mastectomy at the end of January. And what they did, it was a double mastectomy with an immediate reconstruction. So modern medicine can take your abdominal tissue and move it up to make breast mounds. And so that was the option that I took, was using my own tissue in order to support that. And so all of that, I didn't require chemo and radiation. When the mastectomy came back clear, they said, you don't need any of that. So I was never ill. I was just a lot in recovery. And so that's where I turned to the journaling, because I couldn't access my regular coping strategies of walking around and of getting outside and doing all of those things.
You made that sound really easy.
You know what? It's the story that I tell myself. When it comes to processing things, I still have more to dig into when it comes to being a cancer survivor. Sure. People will tell me that. I'm just like, oof, like there's still resistance there. I've got the identity on lockdown for like widow and, you know, wife of someone with mental illness, but the cancer survivor, I'm still working through that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I recall from our conversation, the way you just posed that, that makes sense, because from our conversation, you led with so much of who you are. And I remember talking about that, but you're defining yourself was different with that. So let's talk about the book. So this led to writing a book. What was the catalyst for that? What aha moment did you have for just, you know what? I think I'm going to write a fantastic book for my story.
Yeah. The catalyst. I like that word. My mom had come to visit and to help me out after my big surgery. And she's a prolific scrapbooker. And she brought with her 3 scrapbooks that she had made of newspaper clippings and cards and photos surrounding Chris's murder. And Alexis was 16 at that time. And she gave these to Alexis to be like, okay, this was what was happening. This was what was reported. But what was reported because of that 6-day manhunt, what was captured in the newspaper clippings that my mom had saved differed from what I had told Alexis when she asked questions growing up that had come out as evidence at the trial. And so she's coming to me while I'm bedridden. Literally, I have drains coming out of my body, collecting fluid. And she's upset because what I told her doesn't match what she's reading. And so it was that was the catalyst. That was me having to revisit that time in my life because I would needed to answer her questions. And that's where the journaling and the insights started to come. And then it just continued. And I was like, I've got a lot to say. I didn't realize the growth that had taken place in the last 17. Alexis started to question me.
Incredible. I do want to spend some time talking about journaling at the end, because we talk on this podcast, we talk a lot about journaling. Well, I use that loosely. Some often we talk often about journaling. Yes. And there's so many different views of it. And I'd love for you to dive. If you see a window about journaling in here, just dive in it. But if you don't mind, I think we should just, I just loved this lessons learned piece, because you, the way you break this down, can I just, like, one at a time, we go through these and just have a little conversation about them? Is that okay?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So the first one, which is by definition is chapter 33, the importance of self-discovery and strength of character.
Yes. So when I was working in the RCMP, I became trained as a character leadership practitioner. And what this allowed me to do was look at self-development and self-awareness in a different way. And so the model that we were introduced to is called the Leader Character Framework. I'm going to hold my hands in a circle for those of you listening. There's 11 dimensions in this circle, and they all have important value. Mm-hmm. And when you have all of these dimensions in balance, it leads to greater judgment. And when you are relying too heavily on one area and maybe neglecting the others, your judgment is compromised, which means your resilience is compromised, because you're not able to make choices that support you in the best way. And there's a Viktor Frankl quote, and it says, between stimulus and response, there's a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. And that is the essence of what we're trying to do when you are bringing awareness to how you are showing up in the world in order to make better decisions. And so it's not about what you're doing, right? You go about your life and you're doing all of the things. It's about who are you becoming while you are busy doing. And when we're able to bring awareness and intention to that, that's where things can shift and change for us. And so that's where, when we're able to pause and notice and slow down a little bit and see how these dimensions are interplaying with one another, that's where we can access our resilience in the best way.
I absolutely love the quote. And I know Ben's lathering up over here, because we're at a point now where I think you're getting into some Ben stuff. We talk a lot about values and beliefs at Chateau, at our treatment facility. Yes. And we talk a lot about that. And I don't want to take anything away from Ben, but I do want to point out, as we start to navigate these last few chapters, there's a tail end of each chapter that says, consider these questions, which are very self-reflective, which are can be pretty difficult. As I was going through them and reading them, a lot of these I've asked, but I don't know that I would have asked these 10 years ago. You know, these questions that are really, who are you and what do you want to be? What do you want for yourself? Do you want, you know, to get out of the rut you're in? So for the listeners, I just want to pose that these, don't cheat, read the whole book, don't go to the back, but the back end of this book, the consider these questions at the end of these chapters. So I think that's fabulous. So
yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Ben, anything on that?
Yeah. I had a couple of different questions. One of them had more to do with, well, let me go back just a little bit before we get into these questions. I know a lot of folks who are encountering grief and challenge, whether it's surviving cancer or murder, or a lot of our listeners are kind of in multiple positions in this situation. I am curious for a little bit of, what's it like for your husband to watch you go through this journey? Most of us didn't grow up being very prepared for any of the stuff you're talking about, let alone knowing how to support and watch someone who's doing it.
Yeah.
I wonder if we could talk about that for a second, because that's probably where some of these values and some of these behaviors and patterns just started to show up. He would have a very interesting perspective. And anyway, I'm curious about that little piece as we dive into this.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate this question so much, because often I've just talked about my perspective in supporting him on his healing journey, and not the reverse of that. I think so Brent has not read the book.
I assume that comes up all the time at dinner, right?
You know, there's a few very poignant episodes that I asked Brent if I could include, and we talked about those in advance, and he kind of said, yes, I trust you to do and share your version of the story. So that level of trust from him is totally appreciated. But I think it's finding myself through the professional support that I engaged in through supporting him and then my daughter as well. We haven't mentioned Alexis, when she was 9 years old, was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. So I wasn't just supporting Brent's mental health. I was also navigating Alexis's. And after her diagnosis, that's where I had a moment of like, throw my hands up. I'm really not equipped for all of these things. And that's when I really stepped into therapy, learning the importance of self-care in order to support those that I love the most, and letting go of things that I don't have control over. Those were the two things that I really had to work on. And I think for Brent, watching me do that work and getting healthier as he's moving through the process, there was some learning that took place for him as well. And so when it came to my health issues, he was in a much better place to support than he would have been like 5 years ago, for example, because of where he was. And so our communication is ever evolving, but stepping into that space for him to say he's scared that, you know, he's 15 years older than I am. In his mind, he's the one that is going to have the health issues first. And so for him to step in into that scary space with me was really supportive. And I don't know if he would have done it without the diagnosis to get there.
Great point. Yes.
Right? And so it's kind of like the level of effort that it took for him to do that and the willingness to do that, I think he would only have been able to do because the roles had been reversed. You know, realizing that I had been the supportive one, now he's got to take on that, was something that helped to balance our relationship. Because some, you know, we talk about marriage being 50-50. Brene Brown talks about, no, that's not the case at all. That's bullshit. Right. You know, you've got to have these conversations. Mm-hmm. So those conversations they were having, we were having, and we were able to step in it. And then I was able to take the support, you know, being the caregiver, being the support person, and then turning that to say, yeah, I can be the receiver of that, was really something that that role reversal was there. And it helped us to become stronger as a family and as a couple.
I think it's such a great point. I think there's times where we forget that culturally, that the tension and the misfortune and all of these curveballs that we all dread, those are the kind of the sandboxes where we learn about our values and where we learn how this works. Most of us have this inflated idea of how great we're going to be, how much we enjoy service.
Yes.
And in those kinds of moments, we do learn something a little bit different. That's cool. Well, I hope it doesn't, this conversation doesn't bring up too much tension for him as this goes public that he hasn't. That's true. Hey, that's true.
Cop to cop, I hope it does. Love you, Brent. So the next one is stop taking things so personally.
Mm-hmm. So much easier said than done.
Right? It makes sense.
Yes, it makes sense. And I think, you know, Mel Robbins is really kind of taken this concept and framed it in a way that people are able to hear it and learn it. The Let Them Theory, actually, so Brent is not a great, he doesn't love reading, but he read that book. And he said in 14 years of talk therapy, he learned more from that book than he had in all of his other episodes. Cool. Because it just, and well, this also, you know, when you're reading something from a place of being a little healthier, you're able to take it in a little bit differently. But yeah, just let them have their opinions and their judgments. And it was with my therapist, her name was June, when she was talking to me about, you know, the power of vulnerability, the importance of letting go and the strength in accepting help when it's offered to you. And for many years, I would take Brent's withdrawal, his anger personally, and start to replay like, okay, what did I do to cause that? Did this conversation trigger X? Without realizing that I have no control over his response. I only have control over what I do. And so stepping further into that and not taking the emotional baggage from my family members and putting it on me, that was critical in me being able to detach and just be like, okay, they're on their own journey. I can support, but I'm not going to enable anymore. And that really changed the way that I was able to access joy in my life from a place of a little bit more balance. Yeah, Ben.
No, I just had a quick question. I think most of us get kind of stuck in the weeds or go on autopilot pretty quick. I'm curious if you, whether it's teaching other people about these concepts or you yourself, do you have a trick of what kind of kicks you out of that funk. Is there a little cue that you have that signals I need to get back to that space that Viktor Frankl talks about?
Yes.
But yeah, I'm curious if you've got any advice or things that you've done that helps people kind of wake up faster.
Yeah. Well, in the book, I talk about using what, not why. And so instead, like, why is this happening? You know, why am I the one who's always getting, you know, this response? Instead, I start my sentences with what. What do I need? What's next? Where can I go from here? Those questions pivot the mindset and help me move forward instead of ruminating on things from the past. And so I will actually physically or mentally envision a stop sign and then start a question with what.
Yeah, I really loved that part within my AA journey. It's really that portion is really self-reflective. And I loved the transitioning from why to what, which is within AA. It's what am I doing? What part am I playing? What have I done? What part of this should I be saying no to? Or what have I impacted? What amount am I receiving that's not mine to receive or own? Yeah, I think it was fabulous. Chapter 35, ask questions that support communication.
Yes. So effective communication is incredibly nuanced, right? And not all open-ended questions are created equal. So I'm like, why did you do that? Yeah. Or like, what were you thinking? That's going to shut down a question
real
quick, right? And so it's not even just what you say and how you say it. It's, are you creating the space to even have the conversation in the first place? And so before you even start to assess the quality of the open-ended questions that you're considering having, we used the number system in our house. So on a scale from 1 to 10, with 10 being, I have the most capacity to engage in a hard conversation. One, I don't have any capacity at all. Brent and I would rate ourselves. And if either one of us is at a 3 or less, we know that the conversation is pretty transactional. Like, what are we having for dinner? What time does Alexis need to be doing this? Who's doing that? So that allowed a couple of things to happen. One, it allowed us to assess the level of support that might be needed in that moment, because what support looks like when Brent is at a 3 is very different than what it looks like when he is at a 7. And it helped to stop take things personally, because it wasn't that he was deliberately not meeting my expectations. It was that I knew he actually didn't have the capacity to go there in the first place. So that allowed a little bit more compassion for each other, for me, and then for him. And then from there, it's okay, asking those reflective, curious questions, similarly to the ones that I include at the end of each of these chapters, mm-hmm. to have the other person go a little bit deeper into what is the root here? What's causing these feelings? Because right now I might be reacting to something that seems very difficult, but what's underneath that? And giving that a little bit more time and attention.
How do my questions tend to provoke confrontation or invite communication and dialogue? What impact does this have on my relationships? How does this approach contribute to creating a safe and inviting space for dialogue? These are fabulous.
Yeah, because when we're engaged, when emotions run high, that's when conversation can become confrontational. And that's often because there's an unmet need.
Or hostile.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of breathing too. Yeah. You know, you talk in tactical breathing, you know, box breathing, trying to regulate yourself, take a little pause helps. Yeah.
Well, I had a quick question, because I think this is a piece that often, you know, first responders or just in general culture, we don't understand. If we've done some of our personal work, the relationship, my identity is not on the line. This one question, this one conversation is not going to define us. Mm-hmm. That's a big one. We put a ton of pressure on ourselves from, you know, I have to fix everything, be everything, make everybody happy. If all of those are what we're kind of carrying around every day, you know, what do you want to eat for dinner could be the beginning of the end. And I think there's pieces like that where people often don't recognize that doing some of that, you know, fearless moral inventory that we talk about in the 12 steps, that seems extra relevant on those days. So if we're not constantly doing some of that maintenance, I think people who don't do the maintenance put a ton of pressure on the language, and the language just feels like exhausting as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But
now there was that dinner was a lead for a pan being thrown across the room.
Yeah. It's lots of tangents we can go on with that one. No, as far as those other questions, you know, there was another question that you had that was, the confrontational language versus insightful language. This is your fault, you need to fix it. Some of that blame. I'm curious what your thoughts are there, because I think when we encounter loads of these little lessons in treatment, people don't realize that blame takes up a massive chunk of their presumptions, as well as the way they posture and even just communicate some stuff. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if we're taught how to engage in these productive ways when we're little. In fact, we're not taught how to feel, right? When we're crying or our kids are crying, we have this impulse to say like, no, like you're embarrassing me. Mm-hmm. Stop those tears, right? When we're not able to let people express themselves, how are we going to be able to support conversations where we are regulated, right? And so, yes, the shame and blame work, like here again, like part of my homework in my therapy was reading Brené Brown's Rising Strong. And that's, you know, changing that narrative and the stories that we're telling ourselves. And shame and blame is such a, and guilt, you know, are such difficult places to heal from without judgment. Right. And here again, when you're asking questions that support communication, coming from a place of curiosity as opposed to judgment facilitates that connection that's required in order to have productive conversations. And you're not going to be able to get to solutions without allowing someone to have the feelings. And this is where I didn't get into it in the book, because I think a lot of this kind of language that I'm mulling over came afterwards, but it's how are we able to allow people, teach people how to access feelings, let them feel it in their body. Come on, police officers, show your tears. Like, how often does that happen, right? So how are we creating these spaces where we allow people to have the feelings that will only then be able to help them formulate words for other things that they want in their life?
Police officers do shed tears. You just never see it.
I hope they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll never see it. It's never shared. Rarely.
You know, it's funny you talk about this, because most recently, this week, we were having some conversations with some officers. And there's this interesting standard that we, as a profession, first responders are incredibly distrusting, right? Mm-hmm. As a professional skill, to some extent, like I need to be constantly skeptical of what people have going on. It's interesting how much in the larger society, we don't trust many people, but we want to be trusted implicitly. And whenever we share something, we expect to be completely believed, and people need to invest and validate and take care of us. But you're right, we're not taught how to reciprocate that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a tough one when it comes to communication, is that if I don't trust people, you can't really fake being engaged. Or if you do, if anything, it just reinforces their trust issues. But yeah, I think there's a lot going on there as we talk even more about stress and some of the more vulnerable pieces of communicating with people. Trusting that is a whole different chapter of a whole different book, but I think that is one that we often are kind of unaware of how much our trust issues gets in the way of some of this communication that's so critical.
One of the things that I found interesting about that little segment was how expanding your vocabulary to identify, and I know we're piggybacking off something we've already drilled down on, but I just found that really interesting. I personally have found it very difficult to articulate what I've experienced, and it's been said to me in this very point, but I love the fact that you're putting it in here. Like, you need to figure out the essence of this for me. I heard it and received it was, you need to figure out a way to tell your story. You need to expand your vocabulary and learn how to tell this story. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. So I guess that kind of going into the, I don't know if it's the next lesson in chapters, but using that helpful language and the introduction of the feelings wheel, right? And so when we're better able to articulate our emotions, the better able we are to relate to them and then help support others in relating to theirs. Like, that's where I found as the spouse and the mom, is when we use the feelings wheel, because this was introduced to our family when Alexis was 9 by her psychologist, but I think it helped Brent and I more as a marriage tool than it did as a parenting tool. It's because what do we often feel? Mad, sad, happy. Like, maybe those are the three emotions that we have, right? And the feeling wheel just takes a larger lens on, you know, are you feeling overwhelmed? Are you feeling frustrated? Does that mean you're feeling lonely? So actually digging underneath, what is anger, right? That's, you know, the imagery we often see, the tip of the iceberg, right, is anger. But that's really made up of so many other things underneath. And when we're able to identify that, I'm actually feeling lonely right now, you're going to relate to that person differently than if you just think that they're mad.
Of course.
And so it's bringing awareness to that. Yeah. And so when we're telling the stories, I do a lot of workshops for first responder spouses about how do you relate to your person who's coming home. And it's about the fear that the police officer doesn't want to bring the trauma home, so they don't say anything. They don't want to relive the episode. And the message is, you don't have to give the details of the call. Just talk about how it made you feel. You know, I went out there and I felt helpless today. Right? Naming those emotions actually help your brain to start to process them differently instead of just suppressing them. And I found the feelings wheel helped our family be able to do that with greater accuracy.
Yeah, we used that accuracy. Oh, sorry.
No, I was going to speak to the feelings wheel about us using that at Chateau as well. It's the same in the book.
No, that accuracy thing, I think most partners want to be of service. But if we cannot help people define what our problem is, they don't know how to serve us.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something that we think it's just this hippy-dippy feelings or all of these things that are just soft and fuzzy. But the reality is that the greater our vocabulary, and there's actually some research now that supports this, especially when it comes to therapeutic journaling. If we can start to push and expand, we actually not only process through the emotions, I don't know about better, but faster or differently, but that practice is something that is often probably brushed past pretty quickly, that we think this is very elementary school sort of behavior of I'm expanding my vocabulary, when the reality is our partners, spouses, or kids are just trying to figure out, I don't know what to do. When mom or dad walks in the house and they're stomping around, I don't know if it's me. I don't know if I need to hide. I don't know what's going on. So when we as adults can give people just a little advantage by getting a little bit more descriptive, man, that changes the tone of the whole house.
Yeah. And Ben, I think, you know, one of the other lessons I learned or I speak about is speaking authentically. Hmm. And that goes right into what you're saying about being able to share what it is that you actually know could be helpful in that
Great
moment.
Point.
And that eliminates second guessing. And that is, you're better able to get what you need in those moments when you're able to share those things.
Which is about building trust quickly.
Yeah. Hmm.
Go ahead. Which is,
I was identifying chapter 37, speak authentically. That's where we are. We're speaking to that area, which is just, I love this. If we move on to chapter 38, confide in someone you trust.
Well, that's just, you know, for me, because that wasn't Brent for many years, right? He was a large source of the emotions and the heaviness that I carried. So finding someone who you can just vent to, who's not who's just going to give you that space. You're not asking for advice. You're able to get it out. And sometimes, again, that articulation gets it out of here. It gets it out of your mind into the world. And then maybe you start to hear yourself back and you're like, okay, maybe I can take a different perspective, or maybe I can organize these thoughts a little bit differently. Or, you know, just getting it off your heart can just be, you know, make you feel a little bit lighter, because when you're going to go back into that environment that's heavy again, you know, you can't sustain yourself like that. And so allowing yourself to share and give your self-permission to be vulnerable with someone else. Mm-hmm. It's just so beneficial.
Can you speak to how you find that person? Like how you identify, am I safe with giving my side, my story? Because oftentimes my experience has been people retreat once they've been wounded or, you know, don't feel like a person can take on the full capacity of your hurt and pain, and then they retreat, and then it becomes just a really lonely journey. How do you find this person?
I have different people for different things going on in my life. I don't expect one person to be able to meet all of my needs. And in fact, that's why, you know, in healthy marriages, you have friends outside of your spouse, because the expectation that one person is going to be able to fulfill all of those things is, if you're lucky enough to find that person, fantastic for you, but you're going to probably want to have a little community around you. And so for me, with respect to grief early on, I was able to identify who had been through grief by the way that they spoke and when they showed up. People who had been there, they said very little and they kept engaging with me. Right? And this was not my immediate family. This was not who I confided in. It was like, there was a lady who came up to me in the little co-op grocery store in Hay River, and she had this presence, and she just asked me, she's like, I see you. I lost my husband many years ago. It was that grocery store conversation that was probably one of the most helpful for me. Being a spouse of a police officer, you know, you're going to know the ones who have been in it for a bit, right? I went up to a northern community to do some teaching. A lot of very junior members there, their spouses are 2 years in. Their eyes are really opened by my story. They're not there yet. They haven't experienced those things. So it's knowing that, the commonality with other people. And this typically came from the people who stepped into vulnerability in order to show me that they'd been there And those were the ones I knew were ready to hear and ready to hold space.
That's awesome.
So it wasn't like I searched them out necessarily. It was often that they came to me.
Just showed up.
Well, I love when folks show up in our lives. And again, I just want to underline how powerful it is for folks like you and folks like this lady. I love that you call her the lady, because it can be any of us that have this prompting to break the ice, to say something, to be bold and just say, yep, me too. And how cathartic that was for you, because that, you know, dramatically increased the chances of you seeing that feature in other people. And to be that person, be that lady for other folks, I think there's something really powerful about us being bold at times, or getting out of this idea when we, I guess on the other side of taking things personally, we recognize all of us are in the same shit together. We're all needing a little bit of help. Maybe it's not just about me, but I love that moment where she decided to speak up. It gave you a chance and, like you said, permission to do more with that. But I think there's also this little piece, though, is that there's people who are just born to be helpful to us. And there's probably some people that are kind of on the edge of the bubble who probably need a little bit of training and a little bit of guidance of how to be that person. And most of us, when we get some of that guidance in a loving way from someone, realize, oh, I can do that. Mm-hmm. I can do that a little bit better. I can be that kind of support. So I love that you talked about that, because I think there's so many folks that feel like, well, that's what therapists do. Or that's someone else's job, or that's someone else's thing. And whether it's about grief or whether it's about connection or whether it's about building that trust, I just love that this nobody just decided to step up one day and just say, hey, I see you. What a cool gift.
Right.
Yeah.
Amazing. Chapter 39. Appreciate all your days.
Mm-hmm.
I love this one.
Yeah. So I don't have good days and bad days. I have good days and better days. And that's just a shift in my mindset, right? I am on this earth. That is going to be I still get to do the things. And so when we are having our hardest times, that's actually where stepping into this habit of gratitude becomes even more important. And you talk about journaling. This is where I really exercise daily written gratitude. I start my mornings with my coffee and my journal. And the first thing that I write are my joy-based values. And I'll share that right now. Those are being authentic, joyful, connected, grateful, and content. And so throughout my day, if my choices aren't aligning with those values, it makes me pause. And then I list three things that I'm grateful for in that moment. And so at 5:30 in the morning, that's how I'm starting my day. And that sets myself up for greater success. I've been doing that now regularly for about 2 years, and I've really noticed a shift in the way that I'm approaching the world, because it just gives you a little boost in the morning.
Speak a little more to the journaling and what that looks like for you and how you do it. So many people, we talk about this often on here. I mentioned that earlier, and I love different perspectives of what journaling is. So is that the only journal in the morning is your gratitude journal, or do you journal? Do you have another one? I have two.
I have
that
two
that I journal, and one of them is more heavy. I don't share that one quite as much. I share it with people who want to see it, but most of the times I don't speak to that. I have a gratitude journal and a heavy journal.
Mm-hmm.
And you just mentioned that you share that. Can you speak to that a little bit?
So the gratitude journal, it talks of, it reminds me of my values. It reminds me to notice things that I am grateful for. I will identify stressors that are going on in my life. It helps me then to list some inspired action for how I want to feel. So I'm like, this is how I'm feeling. I want to feel this. What is the action that's going to move me from A to B? And so this is like a standard template that I go through every morning. The other one is when I'm noticing that there's some tension or there's unease or there's big feelings that want to come out, that's when I just let it free flow. And I find that that's where the insights will come about what it is that I am feeling, where do I want to take that? And so those are that kind of free flow narrative. I don't do every day. It's just kind of when I feel it. But, I've stepped into entrepreneurship. There are different opportunities that are coming to me. And I really want to sit with myself to make sure that the ask is aligning with the energy that I have and the way I want to serve this world. And that's where I put more focus on the free flow narrative.
I love that. Let's keep moving. So chapter 40, then we just have a handful left. Chapter 40 then is talk regularly about mental health.
Yeah. So in the RCMP, I was the divisional mental health champion for a time. And part of that work was to assess the psychological health and safety of employees, work with those employee groups, and then create initiatives that would help to support employee wellness in the organization. And it was through those conversations that I started to share my story a little bit more broadly in that effort to help other people step into that space. And I was also teaching a program on reducing stigma and creating awareness about your mental health. And so the more we are able to talk about how mental health impacts our lives personally, professionally, the more it contributes to that stigma reduction. And the more likely we are going to be able to let that other person know that we're a safe and a brave space for them to land when they're ready. And so it's just normalizing the conversation that in the professions that you are in, you are going to have hard things happen. There will be tough days. And when you want to talk about them, I am that open door. And, you know, maybe they'll come to me for a little bit, you know, again, confiding in someone you trust, it's linked. So the more you're able to talk about and normalize the conversation in an effort to reduce stigma in our communities, that's what I mean by that. So just talking about it and keeping it in your conversations, in all of your social circles.
That's such a huge point. I think that's probably one of the harder points that we try to convince our clients to adopt, even though all of them have a personal story of when someone else decided to share. And it may not always be, if anything, I'd say probably don't talk as much about diagnoses, but just talking about these courageous moments or these little aha things. I think that post-traumatic growth does not get a lot of airtime, does not get a lot of space in different departments. And it just takes one person's story to kind of change the tone and the climate. Because if not, unfortunately, the other stories end up dominating the attention. And that is betrayal and blame and victimhood and all of those kinds of things. And people don't recognize it. And we were, again, talking about it this week here with the group. The default is sometimes of how shitty the world is and how you're never going to get yours and no one's ever going to appreciate you. And that is, if that's the cloud you've been spending the last 20, 30 years walking under, I don't know how you have the courage to do some value-based work or to be really present for your partner on some of the days that really matter. Mm-hmm. So I think that chapter and that point are such a great point. We've got to be the ones that do that because no one else is going to do that for us.
Yeah.
But I know that, the betrayal and blame obviously gets more airtime because it sells newspapers and sells time out of our mouths. And right. Because that's the wagon that everybody can jump on and be safe. And I feel like, I'd love to hear both your thoughts on this. I feel like when somebody opens the door to, this is where I'm at, which is very against the grain, very against the norm of, hey, I'm hurting over here. And here's me. It becomes a really, changes the temperature. It changes the nuance. It changes for a lot of people, not everybody. Some people are just going to be old and cranky. That is what it is. But there's people in the room, just like the lady did to you. There's people in the room that say, whew, I'm glad he did that. I'm glad she did that because now I can speak. You know, I can raise my hand and I'm saying I'm hurting too. And I love Ben's point here with these little courageous moments of, and that's one where that person that raises their hand and say, you know, I'm not doing well over here, which then becomes a safety net for others. Mm-hmm. Love to hear your thoughts from either one of you on that.
Yeah. I love that when someone is vulnerable enough to do that, it doesn't necessarily mean that the other people in the room in that moment are going to share, but they might leave and be like, okay,
right.
You know, Brad was able to say this and now I'm thinking about where I am and who I might want to talk to. So it's acknowledging as that it doesn't, the impact, it's immediate, but it might not show up in the same way for a little while. And that's okay too. But that's the power of starting the conversations. And then it's like, how do you keep those things going?
Yeah, right point. I think we often forget that our vulnerability is part of how we create our credibility in relationships.
Yeah.
And we often think, well, as long as no one knows I'm suffering, then I'm the go-to guy or I'm a kick-ass woman. Mm-hmm. When the reality is that most people know we're lying. And we think we're doing this great job of pulling off this. No, I think that's such a great point. And again, such a great part of your message is that we've got to show up and be that for our sake and for them. Yeah, I love that.
For sure. Chapter 41 is Hope Can Save a Life.
Yeah. So that building on the essence of the importance and the power of storytelling. Right? What is it that we can share and who are we going to share it with that's going to make a difference? And this is like the lady in the store. Mm-hmm. Right? Being seen, being a place where we can have those conversations. For me, the most poignant time that this has shown up in my life. So I was flying from Ottawa after the funeral back to Hay River, and I needed to stop in Edmonton to sign a bunch of papers. And it was arranged for me to meet Kim Gordon, who her husband was one of four Mounties that were murdered 2.5 years before Chris's death. And she was pregnant and raising a toddler at the time. And so here again, it wasn't what she said to me that day. It was that she was there to show up. And by virtue of her showing up, I'm like, you got through this. I can get through this too. Like, you and I have had this same experience. You are still living and breathing, and you have these wonderful babies. I can do that. And so it's just that power of seeing other people move through the hard things that gives you a little bit of inspiration and motivation to continue to step into that space. Again, how is the story that you have, how can it be utilized in order to support other people?
Love it.
I love that. Well, I think there's a piece in there that I think, again, I think that little snippet of the story is powerful because she didn't have time. She could have easily said, I got stuff to do. I don't have time for this. I don't have the space for this. Yeah. I think we have this weird romantic notion that people who have nothing on their plate are the ones who are really going to overcome issues. I think it's because we're overwhelmed. I think that's where the empathy kind of kicks in, and we all can relate with that. Mm-hmm. That's a great point.
So chapter 42, then, grief is complex.
Yeah, I don't know how many pages that chapter is, but I could, you know, a whole book on that one, right? Because grief is just, even though it is a universal experience that people are going to go through, how you navigate that is just so different for everyone. And some people feel like others are trying to fix them or make them move through things faster, right? And it's not like you're going to ever get over grief. Right. You just learn how to carry it differently. And so it's really stepping into how are you able to be compassionate with yourself and not compare yourself to other people and what they're doing and the pace that they're doing it at. And so this one, it's just, and I offer a metaphor about the ocean of grief in that chapter as a powerful imagery, right? It's unpredictable. It comes in waves. It's going to take you down. But when you're ready, there's a life ring. And so whenever you're able to grab onto that, you know, let the people pull you into shore, and you're always going to get wet. Your feet will always hit that water, you know, but you're going to relate to it a little bit differently, and you're not going to be as tender over time. And then you can help support those coming after you. So it's really about taking what you need when you need it and at your own pace, and letting yourself know that all of that is okay.
I think it's that part was really fascinating, because giving yourself compassion, that's what I had to do. So I think oftentimes we attribute grief to, it's just loss of your husband or loss of a family member. But I love the fact that you say grief is not linear. It's complex. It can be attached to a multitude of things. And what I found about my life was I had lost a series of things in my life, none of which were a human being. Mm-hmm. And the complexity of my grief and navigating a tremendous amount of losses, I really identified with this chapter, because this was a journey I'm on. And I still to this day have to tell myself it's okay to talk about this, because oftentimes, you know, I lost a friend group, I lost a home, I lost a career, I lost all these things in just a short amount of time. And giving myself permission to speak to that, because it wasn't my dad, it wasn't, you know, a partner killed in line of duty. But this is still grief, and it's complex. And I think many people don't realize that they're oftentimes in grief when they're grieving something, the loss of, you know, a position, a betrayal, a divorce, a pet, you know, you've given your heart to something, and when that's taken away, a little tiny piece of your heart, or maybe a big chunk of your heart, goes with it. And you try to deny that. I remember talking to myself saying, well, this can't be real. It was that internal narrative, right? I don't have that right. I didn't lose this. I lost, you know, Rocky, Chris and Nick, but I didn't lose, you know, that makes sense. But losing a home or a career, suck it up. This is not that big a deal. And so I really appreciate that part of just giving yourself a little bit of grace and compassion and find support for that.
Brad, as we talk about the complexity of this, I think a lot of folks focus a lot on the subject of their grief. And I would say easy top three biggest challenges for our first responders that are actually getting some help is they didn't understand what grief looked like. They didn't understand that their drinking or their anger or their fear or their trust, there's just so many different issues that they thought was maybe depression, maybe trauma, maybe some other stuff. And a lot of it was just, you haven't talked to anybody about anything ever.
Right.
and just the grief process, it just gets so little attention. And I'm glad that your book certainly points at it. But I think there's moments where we forget that's a human need that is incredibly strong. And if we don't find, again, the language and the opportunities to do that kind of stuff, that can metastasize like other things.
And just the, grief is such a small word, but it encompasses so many emotions, right? And so if I am, and then, we talk about Kubler-Ross and stages, all of those types of things too that people know about, but it's just like, if I am pissed off and I'm angry and I am in despair, that's okay. Mm-hmm. Alternatively, if I am quiet and I am weepy and I don't want to be around anyone, that's also okay. And it's going to show up and look different. And it's going to show up and look different depending on what type of grief you're going through. And you're right, Brad, but there's that comparison of, oh, she lost her husband through like gun violence versus my son had health issues and passed that way. And so what's worse? There's no comparing, or there shouldn't be comparing. People do it though. Right. And that stops them from being honest about what they're feeling with other people, right? I remember there was a book called How to Talk to a Widower. It was fiction, but I reached out to this author afterwards and I said, if you've experienced this before, it is exactly, and I'm trying to remember. I don't have it handy right now to give the author's name, but it's just when you find something that resonates at that moment in time, it makes you feel like you're not alone, right? And that may not resonate now. If I go back and read it, I'm not in that same place, but it's just like allowing yourself to experience and be and talk about all of the things, right? And the loss of a dream and the loss of, when you've got members who have such an injury that they can't go back to operations anymore and they can't carry a gun and they're on light duties, holy shit, is that hard for people, right? And so it's like, how are we able to help those folks navigate these things? And it starts with, accessing and acknowledging where they're at.
Absolutely. Chapter 43, last chapter, the value of seeking professional help.
Yeah, in our communities especially, that stigma is so strong. Sure. They don't reach out when it would benefit them the most, right? And this happened to Brent. Like, he literally had a central nervous breakdown. We were driving from my sister's house in Toronto back to Ottawa, driving on the 401, and that is the busiest highway in Canada. And he abruptly crosses four lanes of traffic, gets over to the side of the road and says, "You need to drive because I can't see." His world was narrowing. He was starting to lose his vision. I drive the rest of the way home. He's got tears coming down his face. We get into the house. I get Alexis in the back seat. And so he's gotten a bit of a head start. I can't find him. I'm calling him. He's not answering. And I thought that he was having a heart attack or a stroke. Yeah. We get him to the hospital, right? They did all of the tests. Nothing was physically wrong. And that's where the conversation with the doctor happened to say, this is your body responding to unresolved trauma and stress.
Had enough.
Yeah. And that's because his body was telling him what his ego refused to acknowledge for many years, is that this is not sustainable. And the irony of all of this is I told you that he was brought in to create that program where cops talk to cops about the hard things. But do you think he put himself in a position to talk to other people about the hard things? No.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's that the more, and which is why I'm so passionate about speaking with these communities about the importance of identifying where you're at on a tool that we call the mental health continuum that identifies different behaviors as you're moving from well to declining mental health to mentally ill. The earlier you're able to identify those symptoms in yourself or as a spouse, the earlier you're able to identify that in your loved one, the sooner you can get in to get the supports that you need. Because Brent's 14-year journey from that episode has had a lot of impact on him, me, our kids. That could, the trajectory of that could have looked very different if he had have gone in sooner, right? Or if they just make it mandatory. I mean, sure, they had annual assessments. Do you think most of the people, you know, you can kind of talk your way through those and let everyone know that you're okay?
Yeah, right? I'm doing great.
That's right. And then you're like, okay, next year, see ya. And then you leave being like, okay, I faked another one of those. So it's like how the conversations you want to change around how are you able to say, I actually need a little support. I need some more tools, right? You've got a 40-pound belt on that's got all of your intervention weapons. What can you do for yourself, for your mental health in order to support that?
I absolutely, I remember talking about this a little bit in our first conversation, and I'll share it on here because I share it often, but I was in that same space. I was helping people. I was on the peer support, ran my own business, helped with that capacity. I even helped people go to Chateau. I knew it was the best in the country. Before I went myself, but when my life fell apart, it was almost a shock to me. I'm like, what? I've got this all together, even though it was a wreck. Everything about my life was a wreck. And, that was why that moment. So I share that with Brent. I think, let's wrap this up. I know we've spent some great time, fascinating conversation here. I want to hand it to Ben, but I want to, first, but I kind of want to tee this up a little bit, Jody, with you just imparting some wisdom to our listeners about the culmination of your book. What would you want for them? But Ben, you want to kind of close us out here on your thoughts on the interview?
Yeah. No, most of us just saying thanks. Talk about a role model of you had every opportunity to say, not me. Someone else can deal with this. I got a kid to raise. I got shit to do. I got all these things going on. And not only have you become that lady, I just think there's something really powerful about that. And I think that everyone's looking for that, all of us want to be that person. But thanks for kind of laying it out there in your book and kind of showing some of those smaller steps. And like Brad mentioned earlier, just articulating the stuff that some people have a hard time putting language to. But no, just thanks for joining us. It's been great hearing your perspective. I hope that we get more and more attention to your book because of this conversation, but just it's easy to see your passion and your insight and your intellect. And just thanks for bringing it to us today.
If you were to impart just... you open your heart a little bit to what do you want listeners to know about, not just the book. I mean, the book's fascinating. It's amazing, but there's a underlying message within your book that is pretty amazing. And if you were going to share something with your listeners, what would you, to our listeners there, what would you want them of them or for them?
For them, just really acknowledge your journeys and the power of your story. And when you commit to owning that can really be impactful for other people. And so I encourage you to dig a little deeper into what it is that you are willing to share with other people's in the hope that, you know, you can bring that hope and that hope to somebody else. Right. And then stepping into the self-exploration in order to have some more growth and development, because that's always part of the journey too. We are always growing and can always learn things. And so step into learning and step into sharing, and the level of connection and community that can come from that space and that work, that's what's going to be the most supportive. And so that's great. What I think I'd love people to take away.
So great, which is again, I go back and I steal, I hear Ben talk about this. It takes just tiny little moments of courage of just saying, no, I'm going to lean into this. I'm not going to run for them. So I'm not going to shut it off. I'm not going to deny myself the opportunity. And it is hard. It's hard. It is painful. It is at times. It is wading through a lot of shit at times of, this is icky feelings or and all the things. I just love this of these things we went through. So Jody, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come on and share with us. This has been an absolutely wonderful conversation, and we wish you and Brent and Alexis the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Brad. And Ben.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.